curved ambulatory at the far end of the crypt below the high altar in the apse of the cathedral above. On the chapel walls, barely visible in the candlelight, were frescoes well known to show the great scenes of Mary, her Annunciation, Visitation, Nativity, and Assumption. Wall niches and shelves held clay vessels of sacred oil and golden reliquaries. In the center of the chapel was an altar before which was spread on the rough stone floor a plush, violet-hued, woven fabric, a Moorish wall covering, far too precious to be laid on the floor, except here, in the sacred place reserved for priests and bishops. Embroidered with threads of gold and silver, the carpet was one of several that the poor fellow soldiers of Christ had brought back from Jerusalem. It was to the luxury of that soft, knotted pile that Abelard brought Eloise. What most surprised Eloise was her own feeling of serenity. The few moments it had taken them to move from the cloister garden along the arcaded gallery and down the spiraling stairs defined for her a great passage. True, Peter had been her guide in that climactic sojourn, but she had come to this brink of womanhood of her own will so that she was ready for whatever was coming now. Having led her to the edge of the carpet, Peter began to pull her into his arms, but she turned away from him. She moved toward the wall, beside the sanctuary candle which was as tall as a man, as round as a bread loaf, and giving off the sweet aroma of beeswax. Its flame danced above her, illuminating the ceiling groins, while leaving most of the chapel with its stand of stout columns in a web of interlocking shadows, which was all her modesty required. Indeed, she was plainly visible as, with her back to Peter Abelard, she began to disrobe. His eyes were upon her, transfixed, and she knew that to him her clothing would be a mystery shrouding the further mystery. In methodically shedding it, she was being practical, not coy. Yet her moves amounted to an instinctive heightening of anticipation, hers as much as his. She stepped out of her sandals. She tossed away her hooded surcoat. She unclasped the first of her two tunics, a dark red woolen garment, sashed with a golden cord, and draping only as far as her knees. It fell to her feet, a blood-like pool. Her unbleached under-tunic had a row of buttons running from the hollow of her throat to below the flat bone at her chest, and though Peter could not see it, her fingers trembled to unfasten them, as much because of the cold crypt as in nervousness. Foreseeing this moment, she had not swaddled her breasts with linen bands so that, when with one brisk movement of her arms and shoulders, she shrugged the tunic off, she was all at once naked. She turned to face him. Later, she would wonder at the moral ease with which she so made a display of herself. Yet that moment was an instance of nature's plain goodness, her own goodness. Without breathing, she watched as Peter Abelard, with his gaze never leaving her, removed his clothing. She sensed that her own calm had cued his. Having removed his boots and stood straight again, he too was naked then. He too was still. They were like a pair of pagan statues, unmoving, separated by the width of the carpet that came from Solomon's temple. It was as if their only purpose was to behold each other. What Eloise saw in Peter more clearly than before was love. Which of them moved first, they would never know. They stepped forward at the same instant and came together flesh against flesh at last. At his touch, her skin itself snapped alive. Peter's arms encircled her waist, His fingers cupped her buttocks, his chest pressed hard against her breasts. His lips took her lips, she took his tongue again, the rough taste of wine. He lifted her high off the floor with strength that gave her a first physically felt perception of his manly vigor. He swung her up into the cradle of his arms, his mouth never leaving hers. She clung to him, he rocked her, she floated. But then, sinking, she half-fainted, suddenly at the mercy of a mystical weightlessness, only to realize that he wasn't falling, but genuflecting, his right knee to his left heel. Leaning over, he placed her with exquisite tenderness on the soft woven fabric before the Virgin's altar, an offering. Her gaze snagged on his tonsure, the cap of flesh that marked him for a man of holy orders, a vowed cleric. The word sacrilege leapt into her mind. To banish it, she looked away only to find herself caught by the sight on the near wall of the Blessed Virgin kneeling before the angel Gabriel. And now the word was Mary's, fiat, be it unto me. On her back, arching up, she opened her legs for him and, with his muscled, naked torso, he slid between them, a river vessel into its slip. Clamping his waist with her knees, she joined her ankles. Somehow, so it seemed, they both knew just what to do, until they didn't. With his groin, he pushed at her groin. He grew rough, sawing back and forth. The grip of her legs slipped, and she rewound them. He startled her with a foul grunt, the animal again. He had tried to enter her, but she was certain that he had failed. He pulled his face back to look in hers, and when she sought the caress of his eyes, what she found instead was the twisted expression of a stranger. "Oh," he said, "oh," an ugly guttural sound, but she recognized a plea. Reaching down to him, she found a way to help, and he began to push her along the carpet. An excruciating pain sliced through her. For an instant she felt herself pulling away in her mind, with a feeling of disgust, for he did seem an animal. She tossed her face aside, rejecting his mouth. But then pain gave way to an expansive wave of tingling, as, well inside her now, he found his rhythm. She found hers. She looked at him, and he was looking back at her. The stranger was gone. This was Peter, her dear Peter. Later, they lay together with Abelard leaning up against the cold marble of the altar, and Eloise leaning against him. They were covered only with his ample cloak, a cleric's cope. The candle-thrown shadows danced around the vaulted crypt. Quod factum est in ipso vita erat, he said. We have it from the Gospel of John. Abelard had only to whisper now, so close were his lips to her ear. Whatever was made, there was God's life in it. It says not God's, she replied. Where in that text find you God's? That is the meaning of life, dear one, he replied. Wherever there is life, there is God. I am come that you may have life and have it more abundantly. And when have we had life, if not here, in this? His hand, beneath the cloak, was cupping her breast. She said, I need not God to know life's abundance or to love it. But life here points to life there, and so with love, he said. Our love is a sacrament of God's presence, therefore not profane. You muster an argument against yourself, brother, not me, she laughed. Having been slightly embarrassed at the discovery of their sexual competency, she was embarrassed now at his urge to sacralize it. What need have we of the sacrament here, she asked. Isn't the love enough? Under the cloak, his hand was moving toward her waist. But surely, dear one, he hesitated. She sensed the return of his interest. He continued, Our presence here in the Virgin's sanctuary requires a rebuttal to that long history of denial. To all who would take offense, I simply want to say, God takes no offense. God's offense? She asked. To her astonishment, then, she realized that offending God had yet to cross her mind. She was satiated. What had God to do with this? Years later, looking back, she would express this sensation of pure carnality, carnality's purity, with robust language, an affirmation that would strike some as liberating and others as lewd. But not now. She was shy still, yet a stranger in the realm of lost virginity. Her happiness was full enough to include the necessary pang of sadness, her womanliness enough to include how she was still a girl. The moment was enough. He was missing her mood. He shrugged. I only mean to say that the church made a terrible mistake in opposing the physical and the spiritual, body and soul. We reverse that mistake, you and I. This is... His hand now was between her legs, his breath caught. The sanctification of desire. As she moved her mouth toward his, she said, Perhaps so, dear Peter. But also, this is just a kiss. A wanton kiss. Chapter 8. After their arrest, Rachel Vedette defined her father's survival as her only purpose, and came to understand that if she did not succeed in getting him through whatever befell them, then he would never not be the ghost at her elbow, the opaque figure blocking light, a permanent companion, pure shadow. And it came to be so. She'd failed him. No. Worse. Horrors followed for her, but nothing to compare to his loss. A barred door swung closed on the deepest part of herself, which isolated her, but protected her too, if a wall of numbness can be called protection. Eventually, she knew that unlike her father, she would live, but she also knew that she would not live long enough to see that barred door open ever. Survival, too, would be imprisonment. Her father's evanescent presence had come to form the core of her condition. Him, with his yarmulke, his pipe, his bowl-stained fingers, his glinting spectacles, his shirt lifted above a pinch of flesh at his waist, his benign expression of gratitude, his mute refusal to look at her at the end. He inhabited her. Here he was, on the tattered daybed in her fifth-floor walk-up room in Hoboken, New Jersey, beside her on the seat in the bus coming through the Lincoln Tunnel, at the next strap on the A-train, at her elbow on the path through Fort Tryon Park on the stone bench in the chapter house of the cloister from La Chapelle-sur-Loire. What fellow commuters and museum co-workers, what ladies in from Westchester, even what lilting chants and luminous tapestries Rachel Vedette found herself surrounded with every day, it all registered only at the glinting surface. The presences of persons and things were chimerical compared with his. In the greatest part of herself, she was simply never not back there, with his head hazily on her shoulder, and therefore never not back even further to the time that had given him hope, the time of the Latin letters she carried, tokens of remembered hope. By the end of July, 2 weeks after the initial arrests, about 5,000 Jews of Paris had been transported from the Val d'Ive to some place less than an hour's ride in traffic from central Paris. In that transit, in the dark of the shrouded military truck, Rachel had paid attention, counting the stops and starts, trying to sense where they were being taken. She willfully clamped down on any other sensation so that she could stay alert and cling fiercely, all the while, to her father's arm with one hand and to her suitcase with the other. When the truck halted at last and the canvas was thrown back, Rachel saw that their truck was one of dozens lined up in the center of a vast horseshoe-shaped housing complex made of huge, linked concrete buildings the shape of tissue boxes. Judging from haphazard scaffolding, flapping canvas, and boarded windows here and there, the multi-story apartments and commercial structures were unfinished, but legions of bundle-bearing Jews were being herded out of the trucks, lined up, and directed into one block or another. French policemen were again the enforcers, and again men in dark civilian suits were supervising Germans. Rachel, assessing quickly, saw that the males among the prisoners, from her truck and others, were being channeled in one direction while women, children, and elders were being driven in another. With alarm, she saw that girls and young women were being singled out and corralled. All across the yard, inside an enormous ring of barbed wire, orders were being barked loudly, more by the Germans than by the Frenchmen. The ugly language hung in the air, along with the noise of truck engines, the clatter of pushcarts, and bursts of static from ill-functioning loudspeakers. Helping her father down from the truck, Rachel was unable to prevent him from stumbling again. This time, his yarmulke fell from his head. Before she could retrieve it, a gendarme stepped quickly forward to bring his stout, polished boot down on the circle of cloth, crushing it. Rachel fixed him with her stare and waited for his eyes to find hers. Her contempt outweighed his. He was barely older than she. His loutish smile faded, and despite himself, he stepped back. Saul bent over to pick up the skullcap, muttering as he did, "Kiddush Hashem." Once, her father would have had no need of reinforcement against such a crude fool. Saul Vedette's resolve had not faded, but the strength needed to act upon it had drained almost entirely away. Rachel pressed forward to confront the gendarme. "Thank you, sir, for giving us the occasion to bless God's name." In the face of her ferocious expression, the fleek blushed, which passed in that circumstance for an unwilled apology. He pointed the way toward the muster point where prisoners were being sorted, and Rachel, holding her father's arm, pushed into a knot of old women. As Rachel hoped, they registered as a group more by age than gender, and so her father blended in just as another elder, and he was not taken off with the other men. Soon, they found themselves in a halting procession, more like circus animals than vested clerics or marching soldiers, that took them ultimately two and three at a time through the narrow door of a seven-story apartment building into a stairwell where the dusky air shut off from daylight was moist with heat. They climbed to the third level, followed a dark corridor, and filed into a large open room well lit by windows, crowded with double and triple-stacked bunks, and divided by two aisles. Rachel quickly put the count of aged couples, mothers with toddlers, widows, and a few stooped old men, some with canes, at 70 or 80. The terrazzo floor of the space was littered, she saw, with tiny black specks, and only as she crushed them underfoot with crackles did she recognize the carcasses of flies. She pushed ahead, dragging her father, to claim their space with the toss of her coat and suitcase, a two-tiered bunk in the far corner of the room. She chose it for its relative isolation, hoping for distance from the general disorder and for safety. Later, after a plump but dignified woman in a rumpled, once stylish tweed suit helped them negotiate the unswabbed latrine, Rachel helped Saul into the lower bunk, a plank bed with a thin straw mattress and a single, threadbare blanket. She removed his shoes, retrieved the cushioning pillow from her suitcase, and arranged it for him. She covered him. Then, discreetly preparing his needle, she injected him. She kissed his forehead. Almost at once, he was asleep. When he woke, she was sitting beside him, stooped under the upper bunk, and she told him part of what she had learned in her quick scouting of their new quarters. "This place," she whispered, "was built to be a modern, planned city, apartment towers and businesses. The war came before it was finished. When the Germans moved in, they used it as a barracks, then for British prisoners, now us." She smiled, as if the irony of their place in this sequence pleased her. What she was not telling her father was that on the fifth floor of this very block, two flights up, she had found a dispensary which was still in the process of being assembled, that the medical unit, a long trek up a nasty stairwell, would hardly be accessible to the general population, was a signal more of deliberate callousness than of bad planning. She had met the nervous young medic who was assigned as its clerk, and whose duties, he said, would include obtaining necessary medicines. She was in his presence only briefly. As she left the dispensary, she had pretended to stumble, brushed against him, and hurriedly moved away, but not before sensing his interest. She sensed, also, how his eyes followed her as she walked away. Her father, she saw, was listening carefully when she said, "We are less than 20 kilometers from Île-Saint-Louis, a place called Drancy, in the district of Seine-Saint-Denis." He stirred. "Ah, Saint-Denis, so named because of the monastery." He half sat up, clutching her sleeve. "His monastery." "Whose?" Rachel asked. "Peter Abelard's," her father insisted. "Peter Abelard's, after the catastrophe at Notre Dame. Benvenisti brought him here. Benvenisti saved his life by bringing him to the monks of Saint-Denis." "A good omen for us, then, father," Rachel said. "We too will be saved at Saint-Denis." Saul let his head fall back on the mattress. Unconsciously, he reached to adjust his yarmulke, then remembered. He removed the skullcap to look at it, the smudges of mud. He kissed it, then placed it beside his pillow. "Hello." Rachel looked up from her book. A man was standing only yards from her in the center of the chapter house. She saw at once from his get-up that he was a priest. Then she realized it was the man from the day before, only now dressed in his black suit and Roman collar. As before, his breviary was under his arm. His other book, Simon Veil, was gone. How long had he been positioned there? "Good day, father," she said quietly. "I was just coming back to Inwood from downtown," he said, "and I thought I'd stop in to my new memory palace." He grinned, but unconvincingly. Rachel sensed an edge of sadness in him. Or was that her own projection, an imposition on a passerby of the desolation he had interrupted? Coming back to herself, she retrieved the sensations of her actual situation. The queasiness in her belly, the cold beneath her buttocks from the stone bench on which she'd been seated through her lunch hour, the chill in her shoulders from the stone wall. That her stomach was queasy might have been a symptom of the culprit angst that had seized her years before and never yielded, but really it was only an effect of not having eaten. She never ate during the day. Hunger was so much a part of her normal state that, apart from an arid intestinal hollowness, she did not feel it. "The cloisters," he said, casting his eyes about. "I'm embarrassed to have ignored this place all these years. I am glad for you, Father, that you found the museum, glad also for us." She spoke formally. Her mind was still partly tethered to that room crowded with tiered plank beds, its air of fear and despair, the metallic gray wash that, in her recall, always veiled the scene like an antique etching of Dante's netherworld. Only by a concerted act of will was she able to return here, a transition through time and space that, whenever she accomplished it, marked her as a woman still capable of hope. To come back from memory was, in some way, to believe that its injury could be left behind. Yet whenever her current life took precedence over the past, the mundane over the terrible, strangers over Papa, she had first to shake herself loose from shame. She forced herself to focus on the figure before her. That this New York priest was an altogether impressive-looking man surprised her. Yesterday, in his plaid shirt and windbreaker, he'd seemed smaller, uncertain. Now he appeared as a man of authority. His black suit emphasized the sharp black of his hair, a lock of which hung as a ringlet on his forehead, an accident. Yesterday his hair had been matted from the rain. "Yes, I'm glad, too," he said absently, still glancing here and there. He did seem somewhat awed, but he said only, "I've been thinking about this place since yesterday. The surprise it was. Hard to explain. But a feeling from the past had brought me here, and then, lo and behold, the past is the whole point. What you said about being consoled, the museum as a sanctuary." "That sounds pompous. Did I say that?" "Something like it." "Memory palace? Surely I did not say that." He smiled, but again thinly, a grimace, really. "No, I guess I did," he said. He made as if to join her on the bench, then stopped himself, saying, "I have the feeling I owe you an apology, but I'm not sure why." "Apology? That is not true, Father. For one thing, I am the one who rudely walked away." "Because I was about to overstep? Am I overstepping now?" "You tell me, Father." He turned to watch a pair of museum-goers pass by, guidebooks in hand. Then he faced her again. "I'd had an odd experience yesterday morning at Good Shepherd. Somehow it brought me here. And then you made me think of Simone Weil, as I said." "Because Simone Weil also was odd?" Rachel Vedette heard the harsh note in her question. And of course, as before, she'd corrected his mispronunciation of the philosopher's name, Vey, instead of Weil. She did not understand why this priest was grating on her, yet his forwardness was forced and came as a kind of plea. Harsh note? He did not seem to hear it that way. He said, "She challenged the faith of the church, not faith in Christ, but in itself. Her refusal to be baptized called the whole thing into question. I think that's why we can't shake her. We Catholics, I mean. I'm not sure about other people."
"Like Jews?"
"No, I meant the others who go on about her, the magazine writers, the New York intellectuals."
"Jews."
The priest took a while to answer, long enough for Rachel Vedette to regret how she was reacting to him. Standing before her as he was, he seemed almost a supplicant, which made him perhaps a bit resentful. She wished that she'd invited him to sit, but it seemed too late for that. They'd fallen into the rhythm of debaters, not at all the way she normally responded, especially to museum visitors whose claim on her deference was absolute. Something else was at work. He said, "I'll admit that your being Jewish did strike me. Struck me as, well, yes, odd. But that's because of where we are, where you are, given what this place once was, a Catholic monastery." Kavanaugh let his eyes drift to the girdered glass canopy that stretched above the cloister garden. "It's different in here," he said, "when the sun is shining." Lifting his book, he gestured with it, sweeping across the light-splashed quadrangle. She clutched her own book to her chest. "Do you add that thought, Father, to avoid talking about my being a Jewess?" His head jolted at her blunt question. "I thought that was an offensive word." She shook her head, "No." "Jewess," she repeated, shifting away from debate style. She struck her docent tone, the one asserting that she was in possession of explanations. "The word Jewess is, how do you say, archaic in English, not so in French. Juif, juive." She shrugged. "The offense is in the intention. In your language, leaving Jewess aside, the very word Jew can be offensive." "How?" he asked. She shrugged again. "Jew lawyer. Jew down." "Is it different in French?" "In French there is blood on the word. Buckets of blood." Kavanaugh hesitated. "I thought German." She said, "French also. Jud is an insult racial." "But Father Kavanaugh. Father Kavanaugh. How quickly we came to this thicket. Complications of being Jewish, you said yesterday. Is this what you meant?" "No, not at all. I meant nothing. But I'm surprised you remember the phrase I used." Rachel, too, was surprised that these after-impressions of their first encounter had lingered. As if to change the mood, she shifted her weight on the bench, adjusting her long skirt, crossing one leg over the other, laying her book to the side. The priest, even standing, unconsciously imitated her, letting a nearby column take half his weight. He put his book down on the ledge. His pose became more casual, hands in his pockets. If she had not thought of him since the day before, she recognized now, neither had she quite dispelled the uneasiness he had stirred in her, uneasiness she was fending off by being uncharacteristically brisk and curt. She had few interactions with men, which was, in fact, a consequence of how she'd arranged her life. Except for the director, whose main office was downtown, her colleagues at the cloisters were women, as were most of those museum-goers who showed up for her little tours. Was it also, though, that to her, inevitably, a priest was in a category apart? A man, yes, but not a man to be taken as such. Which it now occurred to her was just the point. Simon Weil's priest, the epistolary interlocutor in her most famous book, was apparently the only man she ever trusted, and wouldn't that have been for the obvious reason? Rachel Vedette realized that this American priest, just by pairing her with the self-punishing French misanthrope, had set this current of negative energy flowing. But was that his fault? If she was bugged by something, so apparently was he. Instead of letting the subject go, he said, "It bothered me what you said about Simon Weil's anti-Semitism. I found myself repeating it to others." "Why?" she asked. She was struck by his mispronunciation again, but this time let it go to add, "Anti-Semitism is a fact." "I know that," he said firmly. "As a Catholic, I am surrounded by it. I'm probably guilty of it." "That, actually, is not the sentiment of an anti-Semite. But, Father, We have done the thing again. This is not the conversation of people passing one another in a museum. I promise you, I never discuss being Jewish here. It is never a subject. At that, even she heard the relief in her voice. She could have said, avoiding such subjects is why I came to America, why I live as a recluse, why no one knows anything about me. So, I do owe you an apology. Kavanaugh laughed. I knew it. I knew it. In saying this, he was so wholly ingenuous that, to Rachel's amazement, she too laughed, laughed out loud. As a way of doggedly perfecting her English during her first year in New York, she had gone to the cinema every chance she got, and suddenly she realized that he reminded her of one of those Jimmy Stewart characters, which made her laugh harder. Yes, that's it, Jimmy Stewart. Even the way he was leaning against the stone column, with his hands in his pockets, the fugitive curl so unself-consciously on his forehead, that slightly doltish but compelling American masculinity, laced as it was with an essential innocence, a goodness. Aware of her own sudden sparkle and wanting to explain it, she said, "When you say, 'I knew it,' like that, you make me think of those fellows in movies, although in movies they add nonsense phrases like, 'By golly,' and 'gee whiz.'" Kavanaugh welcomed her turn toward levity, and he matched it, saying somewhat goofily, "Slang tossaways designed to avoid taking the Lord's name in vain." "You are not serious." "Sure I am. 'By golly' is 'by God.' 'Gee whiz' is 'Jesus.'" At that, they both laughed again, harder, handing themselves over to the absurdity of such nonsense, and then, within a matter of moments, recovering themselves, they both fell awkwardly into silence. Rachel felt foolish, and sensed that he did too. Seeking to swat the awkwardness away, she said, "In French, we just say, 'Mon Dieu,' and refuse to worry about it. You Americans are a nation of delicate conscience. We French know nothing about conscience." When Rachel saw the priest's expression display a moment's confusion, she guessed that it disoriented him to think of her as French instead of as Jewish. Or had he made the switch? Not so long before, in Rachel's world, the categories were mutually exclusive. But he knew no more of that contradiction than a Jimmy Stewart character would have, and sure enough, with an air of "aw shucks," he said, "As a priest, of course, I know everything about conscience." The statement was meant to be self-mocking, but it fell flat. The silence settled once more. He took his hands from his pockets and stood up straight, away from the column. He retrieved his breviary from the ledge, turned slightly toward the garden, and looked up. Clouds had crossed into the sky above the canopy, and a chill had returned to the space, which was neither outdoors nor fully in. Rachel, who almost never noticed the loop of Gregorian chant that ran endlessly in the cloister air, heard it now, a choir of monks, of Catholic clergy, men like this one. "Yesterday," she said slowly, "when I turned to walk away, you had indicated that you wanted to tell me something." He said, "Which was why you turned." "Yes." "You saw how I'd arrived here, driven by the rain, half lost, strangely defenseless. Are you inviting me to return to that moment?" Very quietly, she answered, "Peut-être." "Perhaps." And immediately she asked herself, "Why am I doing this?" But then she knew. Only 15 minutes ago, in her memory, she had been cradling her father's head in the lower bunk at Drancy, fully aware of what she would willingly do to give him a chance to live. Simon Veil's self-loathing was nothing compared with hers. Now she said, "Is that not the magic of your confessional box, unburdening oneself to a stranger?" "Golly," Kavanaugh said, but without a hint of mockery, now. He looked directly at her, and she found it possible not to look away. They were still alone. She was still seated on the stone bench, against the stone wall of the chapter house, the place of monastic self-abnegation. He was upright before her again, like a medieval supplicant, yes, presenting himself to the abbot. But who was she to have such an association? He said, "Unburden." The truth is, yesterday the question was simple. Today it is vastly more complicated. "Complications," she said. "Miss, I wouldn't have a clue how to speak of what..." He let the sentence hang. Finally he went on. "But if I did, something tells me, forgive me, I could speak of it to you." Rachel wanted to nod, or offer some gesture of acceptance. But she did not. She had no idea where the impulse to invite his confidence had come from, nor was it followed now by anything else like it. She was relieved, grateful, that he was incapable of saying more. If one confides complications in a stranger, does the stranger not become a friend? If a confessional box offers immunity from unwanted intimacy, why not a chapter house, the place, as she routinely explained to tourists, where, chapter by chapter, the violations of St. Benedict's rule were confessed, punished, and forgiven? She was a connoisseur of the setting, and it might indeed have made it possible for her to offer some gentle word, something personally noncommittal, but nothing came to mind. Chapter 9. At the end of a garden, the wall which I scaled by a ladder of ropes, I met my soul's joy, my Eloise. I shall not describe our transports, they were not long. For the first news Eloise acquainted me with plunged me in a thousand distractions. A floating Delos was to be sought for, where she might be safely delivered of a burden she began already to feel. Without losing much time in debating, I made her quit the canon's house. It was Peter Abelard, not Eloise, who needed some sort of objective confirmation of her condition. By the time of this garden encounter, she had resolved the womanly riddle for herself. But what could he know of such things? The absence of blood flow from between her legs, groin fire, nausea, painful tenderness and discharge in her breasts. Eloise had come to the understanding with trepidation. She took to pressing against the folding door of her vulva, the small purse of silk that held a sliver of the veil of the Virgin Mary. Her own mother had, in that way, applied the relic to herself during many confinements. But Eloise shuddered to recall that in the end the holy object had done no good. Her mother's eighth child had become impossibly lodged in the channel of her womb, and both the child, a boy, and her mother had died. Eloise, as a girl of 13, had stood by, pressing damp cloths against her screaming mother's forehead, until she cried out no more. As for Eloise tonight, her screaming was silent. God's mother might have been expected to mock one whose conceiving had had more to do with transports of grunting flesh than with angelic visitation. But God's mother, too, was husbandless, ready for shame. Indeed, Eloise chose to believe that God's mother would be more stirred than vexed by the secretum secretorum. Eloise, for her part, was vexation itself. And now, as this meeting approached, there had been not only God's reaction to fear, but Peter's. Yet once again, when she finally turned to him, his large heart took her by surprise. He was waiting for her at the garden wall, expecting something else. She went into his arms, but there was no question of yielding to him, or to herself, for that matter. "My darling Peter," she said with forced calm, "tonight we must do our talking at the start, not the finish. I have things to say to you." He pulled his face back from hers, holding her then with his eyes more than his arms. She sensed it as he read what was written in her expression. "What, my dear one?" he asked quietly. Beside the wall was a stone bench, and they moved to it. It was a midsummer night, in the stretch of time when all in the cathedral close were hard asleep, well before the sounding of matins. An ample moon was high in the sky, and in its light the settle stone glistened with the film of river dew. The air was cool. Each wore a woolen cloak, and each drew it close as they sat, ignoring the moisture on the bench. Eloise spoke of her circumstance with measured cadence, a report she had rehearsed in her mind. Peter allowed her to complete her explanations. Then he simply drew her into the shelter of his arm. For a long time, they clung to each other. Finally, he said, "We must be sure." "I am sure," he said. "Hippocrates recorded cases of phantom parturition." Eloise laughed, though she was in no way amused. Peter blushed. Even he saw the obtuseness of what he'd said, the cowardice of it. "I did not mean that," he offered, the first reaction of adult. "Let me say instead what I truly mean. What matters most and first, we must see that you are properly cared for. Your uncle, my uncle, will regard you as the source of mortal dishonor," she said. Suddenly, Eloise pulled herself away from him, turning to clutch at his tunic, making fists around the fabric with which to shake him. "He will be terrified of my cousin's reaction. He will grovel before the bishop to deflect the loss of his benefice." Such was the litany of dread to which, night after night, Eloise had submitted. It poured from her now. "While the bishop, imagining me as more royal than I am, will fear for the king's honor. For all of this, my uncle will be deranged with anger. But that is the least of it. Our child will be deformed." "Eloise, no, listen to me. Corrupt unions produce corrupt children. You know that." "I know no such thing." "It's the decretum." "The decretum be damned," he said. "Is our union corrupt?" She said, "If the child is whole, the church will seize him as its slave. Filius Nullius, the son of one tonsured, is the son of no one. He will be a thrall, and you've seen even here how such poor bastards are treated." Eloise's fear was well-founded, for in the wake of the Gregorian reforms, the church was just then imposing fierce new disciplines on clergy. This was happening in the name of chastity, but even Eloise knew that the real issue was lucre. When the ordained men died, their putative wives, sons, and even concubines were laying claim to the properties over which the tonsured class presided, from pope, bishop, and abbot, down to parish priest and oratory chaplain. Therefore, clerics and monks had to be universally reined in, the entitlement of ecclesial heirs eliminated. The most efficient way to do that was to enslave the sons of all who'd undergone the laying on of hands. Enthrallment was a present solution and a future deterrent. "If the child is female," Peter insisted, "the church will care nothing for her, whether I wear the tonsure or not." "The child is male," she said. "You cannot know this," he said. "But I do. Joanna showed me." "Joanna knows of your condition?" "She is my maidservant. Of course she knows." "What did she show you?" "A drop of leakage from my breast into a bowl of water. If it floats, a girl child, but in my case, it sank. A boy. In what text does Joanna find such a method of assessment? The text of what women know, she answered. There are other texts, my lady. Peter silenced her by drawing her face into the hollow of his neck. And for tonight, our concern is not with the child, but with you and you alone. A burst of feeling stopped her lover from speaking more, and Eloise read it. Unspoken between them now was the fate of her mother, but Eloise had described that horror to Peter, and he knew that she had never put it out of her mind. For them, it was the particular instance of the general condition that bringing a child into the world was the most dangerous thing a woman could do, a brutal God's punishment of baneful Eve. Abelard collected himself and said, "We must learn what you need. We must be sure that you are well." With her face closed into the cleft of Peter's throat, the dolors of Eloise seemed wholly private, and she wept. That she was carrying a child conceived in sin, a humpback child, an imbecile, brought implications she could not openly acknowledge. In truth, the near certain deformation of her child defined her fear as much as the dangers of delivering him. The only reprieve from her anguish came from this fresh taste of Peter's love, which alone outweighed her worry. His love, pure, constant, redeemed the iniquity of what they had done. After a time, he said, "Come now." He stood, pulled up his cowl, less for warmth, she sensed, than to cover his tonsure. He still could not be seen with her alone, even in the night, especially in the night. She let him adjust the hood of her cloak, so that she too was covered. Nor did she resist as he led her out of the garden, through the horse gate into the lane that ran along the north wall of the close. Because of the moon, once they were out of the shadow of the looming cathedral, the hooded pair could make their way without a torch, and Peter moved them along as if he knew just where to go. She let him lead her, consoled to have finally yielded her will. Soon they were in the ghostly warren of shuttered market stalls, a silhouetted salmagundi of vacant lean-tos and booths, where rats scurried away at their passing, and where the stench of melon spoilage and butcher's offal rose from the runnel that divided the street. Peter nudged her away from the scummy puddles while Eloise, leaning into him, carried her skirts. At one point, an upended miller's cart blocked the way, and for a moment Eloise feared the obstacle as the trick of thieves, but Peter, releasing her, simply hoisted the cart up and with a grunt pushed it aside. No thief would challenge such a man. When he took her by the arm again, she asked, "Where are we going?" He said, "To one who knows." Again she yielded to him. When they left the market labyrinth behind, the street narrowed even further, now hemmed in on both sides by huts made of woven sticks and dried mud. As they went deeper into the quarter, huts yielded to timber-framed houses with second stories. The structures loomed over the street, blocking the open night sky and its moon, plunging the couple into a tunnel of shadows. Here, the stench of the market gave way to aromas of curdled milk, boiled roots, and dampened ash. Eloise felt a wet breeze on her face, the river again. Therefore, they were not far from the north bank of the city island. "Wait," she said, "where are we?" "Just come," Peter answered. "No," she stopped and pulled away. "Where are we?" He answered, "Vicus Judaeorum." "The Jews' quarter?" Now she understood her discomfort. The district between the market and the river was forbidden to Christian ladies. She had never entered it. Why are you bringing me here?
Prince Isaac ben Joseph Benvenisti. He has what we need tonight. Wisdom and science.
Prince? What prince?
Prince among the Hebrews, Abelard muttered. They say Nasi, we say prince.
Benvenisti was the elder of elders, a sage from Toledo in the kingdom of Castile. He had come to Paris to establish an academy for the study of Talmud, but holy books were only part of his expertise. Among Jews, he was a legend on both sides of the Pyrenees.
And he receives intruders in the depth of night? She asked.
Shh, shh, dear woman, we are not intruders.
Peter, we cannot do this.
We are doing it. The depth of night is the best hour. No one will know of our meeting.
Meeting? Where?
Here. At that, he turned and rapped softly on a nearby door.
We cannot do this, she hissed.
But Peter Abelard did this once a fortnight. With all discretion, he regularly presented himself to Benvenisti for instruction in the texts coming from Al-Andalus and for tutoring in the language of the Moors. But on this night, medicine was the point, and Prince Isaac was a master there, too, knowing the herbals and the lapidaries, knowing the four humors and the course of blood. But Eloise was still resisting, pulling back from the door. Abelard held her close to whisper,
"The king, our king, has given him the physician's privilege."
"Physician," she said, "my condition is a matter for midwives, not physicians, women, not men."
"I honor your superior knowledge, dear Eloise. I admit my ignorance. But on matters of the body's well-being, Prince Isaac is the wisest man in Paris, from birth to death."
"How do you know him?"
"He is my tutor."
"He is your Jew?" she asked. "What they say of Abelard and his Jew is true?"
"Perhaps, depending on what they say."
"That your mind is turned," she said. "A Jew has twisted your thought. Your enemies say that."
"Would that my mind could be turned by such a one. It is true I entrust my thought to Prince Isaac."
"And now you would entrust me?"
She clutched at his garment, insistent.
Abelard reined in his impatience. He well knew that the Iberian Moors had opened the secrets of medicine to the Jews, secrets of Hippocrates and Galen and Ibn Sina, secrets that did indeed have to do with childbirth, whatever women said. Still, with his voice lowered, though it was now laced with impatience, he said, "I will not have you burning incense to planets and frogs." He might have added, such was the wisdom of the women, and sucking on the severed right foot of a crane. Instead, he said, "When your time comes, I will not have you clutching a piece of the toenail of St. Mary of Magdala."
"Of St. Margaret," she said.
"Who died a virgin," he said. "Why should a virgin be the patroness of the pregnant?"
He covered her hands with his, pressing them.
"Rationality, dear Eloise. That is what we need. You know this of your own experience."
Eloise buried her face against him. Peter stroked her, saying, "I am thinking of your dear mother." Her voice was muffled when she said, "I think of nothing else."
"Then it is settled," he told her. "We must know what your well-being actually requires."
She pulled back, looked at him, and began, "You are the only man to whom I reveal myself. You must..." Before Eloise could object further, the door opened. A white-bearded man appeared, his craggy face illuminated by the flame of an oil lamp he held at his breast. On his head, he wore an odd three-pointed cap. He stood in what she now saw as an exceptionally solid door frame, to one side of which was nailed a small tube of parchment. Protruding from above the door was the timbered overhang of a second story. Eloise took a step back and